Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Chilling tales for dark nights.
The following program is a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcast Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com to learn more about this and our other weekly storytelling programs, and become a patron today to show your support and get instant access to our extensive archive of downloadable tales of terror. Thank you for listening, and enjoy the show. Disclaimer. Horror Hill is a horror anthology podcast bringing you scary stories from all corners of the internet and beyond. As such, certain stories include content that some listeners might find offensive. Listener discretion is advised. Greetings, listeners, and welcome back to the Horror Hill podcast. I'm your host, Eric Peabody. Tonight, we're welcoming author Tom Russell back to the show with three tales from his collection 100% Unfiltered Nightmare Fuel. We open with The Last Case, where a London private detective details the events leading to his change in occupation. After that, we have Why I Drowned My Wife, which, frankly, is too bizarre for me to even try to synopsize here, though I did find it deliciously entertaining. And then we'll finish up with Spying on Grandma, where a harmless game of childhood tomfoolery ends up revealing much more than intended. That's it, folks. No overarching theme for this episode, no moral, no message. Just me, some dubious British accents, and a whole lot of nightmare fuel. You're listening to the free edition of this program. If you'd like to help support Horror Hill and also remove these pesky ads, head to chillingtalesfordarknights.com and click Patrons in the upper menu to sign up today. You'll get instant access to hundreds of ad-free stories, so what are you waiting for? Also, if you're watching on YouTube, do us a favor and drop a like and subscribe. Become part of our dark circle, listeners. And now, from author Tom Russell, I give you The Last Case.
I'm putting this up here because I want to keep it separate from my other case files. You'll see why. For now, just know it didn't feel appropriate to keep it with the endless logs on cheating spouses and track down runaway teens. My level, I almost didn't type up this file at all. I nearly burned it. I'd have been more than happy to pretend the following never happened. I changed my mind because I figured that if I stayed silent, somebody else might accidentally go poking down the rabbit hole. So yeah, my story. What you're about to hear took place back in the early 2010s. I didn't know it when I signed the initial contract with Anna Bockstead, but it was the last case I ever took on as a private investigator. Something about the whole gig didn't feel right after. I don't think you'll blame me for moving on to my current career as a debt collector, though. It started out routine enough. Got the call on a Monday morning while I was groaning away a hangover and the steam from a piping cup of black mud. London is a big place, and I'm good at finding people in it. My caseload was never slim, let's put it that way. The phone ringing first thing on a Monday wasn't unusual. The nature of the case is what excited me enough to put it to the top of my schedule. The caller was Anna Bockstead, 56, from Acne. A case, her son, Ian. Namely, what the London Metropolitan Police weren't telling her about how he died. Anna didn't agree with the Met's verdict that Ian died by his own hand. When she came to my office that afternoon, she brought screenshots of private conversations. Screenshots containing her son's plans, dreams, hopes from the future. Most recent of which was around booking holiday, written a few hours before his allegedly self-inflicted death. Alone, these wouldn't have led me to suspect I was dealing with anything other than a grieving mother in denial. But then she showed me the photos she'd sneaked of his body when she'd gone to identify it. Sure, Ian was covered head to toe in deep cuts. His nose was broken, and his naked body was covered in dirt like he'd been sleeping in a dumpster. It was the body of someone who went through a lot of emotions and hardships in their final moments. I agreed with Anna Bockstedt, though. This wasn't the body of someone who showed themselves out of the land of the living. Folk who choose their own ending don't die with screams on their faces. Ian was found about 3 days after his death in a car park behind a warehouse. There were drugs in his system, but not at the levels that should induce dangerous behavior or overdose. Anna's research had been thorough, and I'd tailed enough junkie kids to confirm the chart she showed me didn't show anything more than a 19-year-old putting a little extra kick in his weekend. The cuts and negligible levels of party favors in his system were what led the Met to rule self-murder. To Anna's delight, I disagreed on both fronts. The wounds couldn't have been self-inflicted. There were too many inch-long cuts and hard-to-reach places for Ian to have made them himself. There are also hundreds of them. He'd have passed out long before getting to the two fatal gashes on his wrists. They were also far too straight, far too precise to be self-inflicted. Ian hadn't been found with a blade, so the ruling was he'd used broken glass. I've been in enough bar fights to know shards of glass can't make cuts that perfect. The big question, though, was this. Ian Bockstedt's body was filthy, covered in lacerations. So where was the blood? The Met weren't being honest with Anna Bockstedt, and I promised her I'd find out why. It's a shame that once I had to start being dishonest with it too. Not because I'm a liar, but because I couldn't risk her digging deeper. My first stop was the possible crime scene. Ian had been found by a homeless guy in an abandoned industrial estate in Bethnal Green. Turned out to be a waste of an oyster swipe, on that initial journey, at least. The Met had already picked the place clean, and a week's worth of the city's background motion had long since washed away any evidence that may have been missed. I figured this would probably be the case before I got there, though. I needed somewhere to begin, and on my usual runaway brat hunts, visiting the last known location was a good way to find that first trail. So, yeah, I didn't waste too long in that empty car park the first time I went. The second time, the time I woke up there, was a different story. We'll get to that, though. At the time, I had no reason to be suspicious. I did need to send some photos I'd taken from my phone to Anna Bockstedt, though. More to show her I was already on the case than anything else. That's why I ducked into the shadowy internet cafe money transfer point across the road from the vacant lot of empty warehouses and abandoned cars. The cramped, poorly lit room was busy. Two beefy blokes behind the counter, a dozen or so scrawny guys hunched over keyboards, crammed into a room built with no more than 8 occupants in mind. They had a nervous look about them. None made eye contact, not only with me, but with each other. They were all working in silence. All I could hear was the whirring of towers, tapping of keys, and the buzz of a fat blue bottle making drunken loops around the ceiling fan. It wasn't till I sat down and booted up the aging Windows 98 that I noticed the lack of speakers. None of the 8-quid-an-hour PCs had them. There weren't even any blaring, tinny, badly tuned local radio from behind the counter either. A distinct oddity in London. The towers were also missing headphone or auxiliary jacks. The audio cable slots of both mine and my neighbor's computers had been crudely melted closed with a lighter or a small blowtorch. I wish I'd been curious enough to investigate this further, and have saved myself a lot of hassle later on. As it was, I just shrugged and emailed the new crime scene photos across to Anna Bockstead, shrugging off the massive red flag as one of life's little weird moments. My second line of inquiry was the list of Ian's friends provided by Anna Bockstead. One of them, a lad based in Elephant Castle, agreed to meet me, an aspiring solicitor named Asim Anand, a now former classmate of the deceased. I was surprised to find Asim Anand was as eager to meet me as I was him. He'd been with Ian on the night of the latter's suspicious passing. He had video evidence to prove it, too. After some brief introductions at his E&C flat, mine clipped and impatient, his shaky and hushed, he showed me a series of clips on his iPhone. I'll spare you the red herring. The illegal rave Asim, Ian, and a handful of other future lawmakers had visited that night wasn't in the warehouse that I would soon wake up outside, covered in sweat and gibbering like a madman. It was a similar disused unit about a mile away, one that was regularly used for such underground events, judging by the intricacy of the sound system and lighting rigs visible on the small screen. The first few videos were normal. Ian and his friends laughing, dancing, smelling the white powder on somebody's coffee table. It was the fourth video that made the color drain from both mine and Asim's faces. It was about 30 seconds into this clip, almost out of shot by the speaker, a few feet behind the gurning Asim and two girls, that Ian changed. Not started changing. Changed. It was instantaneous. One frame, he was Ian Bockstead, and the next, he was not. In the space of a single strobe flash, Ian went from grinning and dancing to standing stock still. He was so tense and upright that you'd be forgiven for thinking some unseen spirit had rammed an iron rod up and through his spine to the base of his skull. Plenty of the other revelers had twisted, contorted faces. Powders and pills have that effect. That's why I think none of them reacted to Ian's new face with the same gulp and sharp intake of breath as I did. One moment, Ian's features had been locked in a happy, toothy grin. And in the next frame, they were still in a toothy grin, all right. But it was far from happy. It was far from anything. After the switch, the corners of Ian's mouth curled up so much they almost spiraled in on themselves. The lips between them were stretched so tautly that splits and trickles of blood appeared within a few seconds. New eyes bulged far further than any chemical could induce. Rings of purple flesh surrounded them as they twitched and heaved in the sockets, trying to free themselves from his face. His eyelids folded back and in on themselves, exposing the pulsing veins and capillaries on their undersides. Over the next 5 or 6 videos, Asim showed me Ian standing in the same spot with that twisted grin from various angles. No matter where Asim had peeled from, the bolt upright Ian was visible in the background, unmoving for what must have been a couple of hours. Asim had studied the footage well, because it took him pointing out the strange way Ian was breathing for me to notice. Impressive, considering I made a comfortable living out of noticing things. Ian Bockstead was alternating which lung he breathed out of. Left, then right. Left, then right. Nostrils flaring alternately in short, arrhythmic bursts. He stood there, leaning to and fro slightly as the opposing halves of his chest rose and fell like a seesaw. Right until the final two videos. I am a proud man. I value my stoicism. It brings me no joy at all to admit that I let out a high-pitched yelp when, in the penultimate clip, the grinning statue did the unthinkable. It moved. On a trigger known only to whatever mind lay behind those bulging eyes, the Ian thing turned 180 on its left heel. It marched through a crowd of gurning ravers, moving its legs with stiff but fluid swings like a parading soldier, a 50s lead wind-up toy. Before the footage ended, it was standing in front of a man-sized speaker, face inches away from the vibrating surface. The last footage was of Asim vomiting purple liquid into a bin. Over his shoulder, Ian Bockstead was clearly visible. He was pushing his head into the speaker with such force that his skull rattled violently. He held it there for a full 5 minutes, until dark streaks started to pour from his ears and pool at his chin. Before the clip cut to black, I was given a glance of his mangled, broken face. A curled grin was gone, the nose was broken, and the blood from the fresh wound was mixed with confused tears. Ian had vanished after that. Nassim Anand agreed to send me the footage on the condition that I never contacted him again. It was very clear that he'd only reach out to me to pass the torch, so to speak. He wanted out. I should have followed his example. Ain't hindsight a bitch. I uploaded the clips to YouTube when I got back to my office and took a nap. This is actually a pro-gamer move in the world of private investigation. If someone's hiding, then they can't resist testing how findable they are. Besides, I had no idea what the hell I was looking at anyway. I was hoping just as much for an explanation of the kind of psychological break that caused Ian's behavior as I was for another lead. My theory was something neurological at that point, you understand? Something still grounded in the rational, the explainable. When I woke up a few hours later, I still had no explanation, but I did have another lead. Among the hundreds of cries of fake which protected my montage video from a takedown, there was one that offered a glimmer of hope. Well, what I thought at the time was hope. What was it the red squid guy said in Star Wars? Anyway, one commenter left a lengthy response urging me to reach out. The poster claimed to have witnessed the exact same thing at another nightclub a few months prior and had a video to prove it. My mind began racing with visions of me on the front page of the papers, the hero that exposed the dangerous new high killing London's youth. I couldn't reply to Speaker Rider 81 fast enough. I fist-pumped when he responded in 5 minutes to tell me he lived so close I could be on his doorstep in about 10. The journey was short, but not simple. The BlackBerry route planner took me down alleys and side passages I hadn't known of before, despite living in the area for over a decade. The ruckus of the main roads dimmed into quietness with each turn. The amber haze of light pollution that I associated with civilization less and less visible on each new, unfamiliar street. My phone assured me the journey had indeed only taken 10 minutes by the time I reached the right road, terraced houses, and the maze of terraced houses. It felt a lot longer, though, and my legs ached to prove it. Other than a hallway light on the second floor of the first house I passed, a bedraggled fox digging through a wheelie bin was the only sign of life. I shivered despite the night air not being cold. Speaker Rider 81 lived at house number 12 on this suburban street. When I knocked on the red wooden door, despite no lights being on in this house either, I found it unlocked and swinging open on a single light tap from my knuckles. I walked in half expecting to find signs of a burglary or a struggle, maybe even a squat full of junkies and vagrants. What I didn't expect to find was the cleanest and emptiest house I'd ever come across. The house was uninhabited, not just by people, but by anything. I spent nearly 2 hours pulling up floorboards and scouring empty cupboards, determined not to have wasted time on what now felt like an obvious prank. Well, what at first felt like an obvious prank. More time I spent pulling apart that house, though, the more my frantic searching regained solid purpose. Something was wrong with that house. Until I found whatever I was looking for, I couldn't put my finger on exactly what. My first guess was show home, but even there decked out with some kind of furniture beyond built-in cupboards. The house's exterior had been filthy and dilapidated like the rest of the street. The inside couldn't have been further from this. Except for the exposed concrete or floorboards, even the kitchen and bathroom had no tiles or linoleum. Every surface had been cleaned to sterility. Recently, too, some of the walls were still damp, and the faint acrid tang of bleach was still in the air. What furniture did remain, the aforementioned cupboards and walled-in sinks and bathroom facilities, had received the same treatment. They had been scrubbed to immaculacy. I doubt I could have even found a flake of dead skin, never mind Speaker Rider 81 or his case-cracking footage. In the end, I gave up and pulled out my phone to call a taxi. The poor woman on the other end of the line had never heard of the address, and neither had her computer system. This was one normality-ignoring lump of weirdness too many for me. I did what I always do when I feel out of my depth. I saw red. My profanity-laden attempts to explain my location were loud. That's why I didn't hear the guy with the cricket bat unlock the front door. When I came to, I was strapped to a chair. The top of my skull ached, and when I moved, I could feel the peeling of dried blood on the back of my neck. I wasn't alone. Three of the men from the currency exchange slash internet cafe were standing over me. They weren't around for long, though. I just had enough time to start yelling at them, reminding them that I recognized them and knew who they fucking were. And they wordlessly turned and left, single file through a heavy metal door. The room it clanged shut behind was as unsettlingly clean as Speaker Rider 81's house. I knew I must have been moved at least a few miles, because the vents and pipes on the whitewashed brick walls screamed industrial warehouse. The smell of bleach was stronger here, strong enough to cough and gag as I struggled against the thick belts holding me in place. There were other smells, too. Disinfectant, chlorine, and other detergent vapors that stung the nostrils and burned the lungs. For a moment, I worried they were gassing me. But when the actual reason for their bringing me here revealed itself, I realized I wasn't so lucky. The only object in the room, aside from myself and the chair, was a small Bluetooth speaker, standing alone on the polished concrete a few feet in front of me. It was one of those portable jobs that couldn't have been larger than my fist. Only a few seconds after I paid it attention, a green LED indicating a paired connection shimmered into life. The music it played to the echoey room was tinny, a warbling mix that was all treble and no bass. The tune itself wasn't remarkable. It was some pop hit that had been popular that summer. Katy Perry or Taylor Swift, I think. How much the screeching tones made my face itch immediately caught my attention, though. I began yanking and pulling against the thick belts, no longer trying to free myself, but just a hand to scratch my face. Within a few seconds, the unpleasant scritch-scratch crossed my every facial feature, had me twisting them in agony. It was at this point that I stopped seeing red and started seeing yellow. Before I could scream, though, there was a click. The glare of the strip bulb cutting out and throwing the bleach-coated room into darkness took me completely by surprise. Surprise that I didn't have long to wallow in. The muscles in my back tensed. The moment the light left, I felt something other than shadow step in to take its place. Something behind me, some presence I was as aware of as the leather belt stopping me from running for the door. I couldn't hear it, but I knew from the growing, prickling, replacing the sensation of dry blood on my neck, that it was taking slow, deliberate steps towards me. I did scream now, a loud scream, a scream even the hypervigilant machismo I inherited from my father isn't ashamed of. It was when those screams bounced and echoed off the hidden walls that I noticed they, and the waves of tinny noise from the speaker, weren't behaving right. They weren't reverberating evenly around the room as they should have been. They were being directed. Every yell, every bar of tinny pop music rushing back past my ears much louder on the return journey. Every sound zipped and whirred like a passing freight train, pulled behind me either by or into whatever was now gut-churningly close to the back of my neck. The itching in my face had progressed to burning by this point, as had the hot breath at the base of my skull. I wrenched against the belt so hard that rivers of warm redness descended from the new flashes of pain at my wrists and ankles. My yells, pleas, and screams were all sucked behind me, whooshing past my ears and vanishing without echo or reverb. A scalding breath moved up to beyond my left ear. The corners of my mouth felt more and more like they were soaked in acid with every inch it moved. I must have still been screaming, but I could no longer hear it. The barrage of sound ripped through every bone and ligament of my body, crushing and squeezing them with an intense pressure I cannot explain. nor do I ever want to be able to. The excruciating vibrations reached their final crescendo when the thing they gave form placed a clawed, bleach-smelling hand on my shoulder. Everything stopped. In an instant, the burning, crushing pressure on my insides and the boiling grip of that gnarled, translucent hand were gone. That would have relieved me, were it not for everything else going along with them. My limbs, a moment ago screaming in agony as they fought a losing battle against leather bindings, had gone. My throbbing eyes no longer throbbed, because they no longer anything. My screaming had ceased because I had no mouth to scream with. I was nothing beyond disembodied awareness, a bodiless sense of dread and wilting sanity, drifting alone in a void. At least, I was alone at first. Once I was aware of my lack of surroundings, things started to notice me. Things that moved and shifted in the dark. Curious things, intrigued by movement in this place, where all had been still since before there was a universe for our star to be birthed in. I could feel, or sense, or know, them circling me. Their hunger was palpable. It filled the empty space, and if I had lungs, the fear I became would have burst them. I felt the first of these unspeakable presences crash upon me when, for the second time, everything stopped. I could feel tarmac against my cheek. That didn't amaze me as much as the fact that I could feel my cheek, and my face, and my arms and legs, and all the other parts I was supposed to have. They hurt, but they weren't burning. Two good reasons to open my eyes. I was in a car park by a warehouse. The same car park the unfortunate homeless man had found the even more unfortunate Ian Bockstead's body in. I was naked, bruised, and covered in a few cuts. But alive. As my memories of how I'd found myself naked, hurt, and on concrete started to return, so too did a panic rise in my gut. I ran screaming from that car park in the end, looking up to see the three men from that sterilized room, one of them menacingly holding a cricket bat, looking down from a window on the top floor, was enough. The message in their hate-filled expressions was clear. That was a warning. Don't go poking around where you're not wanted. At first, I thought they were worried I'd expose them. Now I know better. I never accepted another case. I shut down my company and all websites and social accounts, but not before crying under a cold shower for 8 hours straight. I've never gone back to Bethnal Green. I don't know if that, those, whatever happened is limited to there. I've avoided spending too long around speakers in the years since, though, just in case. I told Anna Bockstead the trail had run cold. What else could I do? She broke down into uncontrollable sobs. And this was when I first noticed something had changed in me. Her tears meant nothing to me. They prompted no pity, yet at the same time, no annoyance. Emotionally, I was completely blank. It's been the same ever since. My psychiatrist uses words like sociopath or personality disorder. I know better, though. When that thing touched my core in the void, it took something with it. It left me half full, partially empty, missing whatever part of the spirit or soul that allows you to connect with others. It's probably why I do so well as a debt collector. The sight of crying mothers and sobbing children does nothing to me as I break a father's arms over insignificantly small missed gambling payments. That's why I don't want you to go digging. I don't want to risk anyone following me down the rabbit hole. As scared of it as I was, the thing in Bethnal Green has blessed me. It chose me. I was worthy, where Ian and the men from the internet cafe were not. It's a burden being their chosen. It's one I wish I'd never taken. But now it's mine, I will never release it. Those things in the dark are mine. Their blessing is mine. When I'm ready, I'll go back to Bethnal Green. I'll turn on my speakers and meet them again. Once more, I will bask in their liberating touch, and I refuse to share it with anyone.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
You've been listening to The Last Case by Tom Russell. Next, here's Why I Drowned My Wife, also by Tom Russell. When we got married, my wife had no toes. I'm starting here because, with God as my witness, I have no idea how else to begin this. That's the thing. I don't even know what it is. Account? Confession? Obituary. I had to write something down. I've taken photos, but nobody would believe she wasn't born. No, stop skipping ahead. Clarity, Benedict, clarity. Start at the beginning. When I married Emily, she had no toes. I married her because of her eccentricities, her stories, and her tall tales. I'd always laughed them off. Especially the one about how she'd lost the digits on her feet. I'd always seen it as a fanciful way of explaining away a birth defect. It never bothered me, but Emily grew up in an orphanage, and, of course, kids can be cruel. I'd always assumed the beach tail was a way to keep old wounds closed. I realize now that was naive. According to Emily, she'd been walking the beach at Dovercourt, a bleak and run-down shipping town on the UK's east coast. It was before her parents' accident, so she couldn't have been older than 4. She had been digging for shark teeth when she found, about a foot below the pebbles and gray sand, a sea slug. This is where the tale took one of Emily's usual flights of fancy. Because, you see, this wasn't just any sea slug. Throughout our marriage, she'd sworn on her parents' graves that the moist creature was the exact size, shape, texture, and color of a human tongue. She even defiantly refused to budge on her assertion that it moved and writhed in her hands exactly like one, too. The Emily-ism that made me write off the story as fiction for years was what it did after a few minutes of wriggling. According to the wife, I'd give anything to hold again. The tongue slug vanished in her hands, disappeared into thin air with no sound or commotion. There one moment, gone the next. You're probably wondering how this relates to her toes, though. Well, the tale of the tongue slug ends when 4-year-old Emily awoke the next morning to find they were missing. Her parents found the screaming toddler in a bed with severed toes and pools of blood, nowhere to be found. The flesh of her feet simply ended, much to her parents' and doctor's confusion, in smooth, blemishless stumps, like the toes were never there at all. Of course, for years I thought the joke was that they never had been. Thinking about the fact that Emily wasn't choking at all still sends a shiver down my spine. It started during the last COVID-19 lockdown. Just like Emily's parents, I was awoken by screaming sobs. Emily was on the floor. She'd fallen out of bed, and I could see why straight away. I wish I was man enough to have leapt from the bed, scooped her up, and rushed her to the nearest hospital. If I wasn't such a coward, maybe I would have, and none of this would have happened. Instead, all I could do was sit up in bed and scream with her. Her calves were missing. There was no gaping wound or exposed bone from a grisly severing, no pools of blood or shredded tissue. They were simply gone,
Emily's knees were now smooth globes at the end of her thighs.
I can feel them! I can feel them! I can feel them!
I've never heard a person yell like that. Her voice cracked and broke like there was so much panic in her lungs that her throat wasn't strong enough to contain it. I'm embarrassed to admit how long it took me to calm down, so I won't. Once I had, I clambered down from the bed and sat behind her. I held Emily in my arms for about 3, maybe 4 hours. I only found out I'd spent that long silently sobbing into her auburn hair later, though, when I crashed downstairs on the faux leather couch that afternoon. When you love somebody and they're that terrified, time becomes irrelevant. Any mother sat at a bedside in a neonatal ICU will tell you this. I sat and rocked her across those hours, telling her to focus on my breathing despite it being far from steady or calm. We got there, though, somehow. She was sobbing throughout me helping her dress. I tried to let her maintain her dignity, do as much for herself as she could, but I found myself overstepping almost every boundary she had. At one point, she actually told me to frick off. Not her actual word, obviously. I'd never heard her swear before. She couldn't explain what she meant when she said, I can feel them, until I'd carried her downstairs and sat her on the sofa. We'd watched a documentary on phantom limb syndrome once. That's when amputees get itches they can't scratch on limbs that are no longer there. Emily made it clear, in a plain and matter-of-fact tone, free of any panic or confusion, that as far as her body was concerned, nothing was out of place. When she had woken up that morning, she thought she or I had wet the bed. From the shins down, all she could feel was warm liquid. The strangest part, the part that had shocked her so much she launched herself from the bed, was that she could feel her toes again. After I came around for my exhaustion nap, we had a long talk. I begrudgingly accepted no doctors would be phoned. Emily made the final decision, of course. I begged her to let me take her to the hospital, but she refused, point blank. Her argument was bulletproof. Legs don't just disappear. They just don't. The best case scenario was the doctor couldn't do anything. Worst case. Well, we'd both watched enough of the X-Files to know people experiencing inexplicable limb vanishing don't spend long outside of military or government captivity. The thought of Emily on a cold steel medical table being dissected by men in hazmat suits. It was enough to get me to forget seeking professional help. In the end, Emily did make one concession. I called Shane, a colleague, and the closest thing I had to a friend, locally. I couldn't tell him the specifics over the phone, for obvious reasons, but my caginess piqued his curiosity and he agreed to come over. He didn't scream, which was a relief. At first he laughed. Then he smacked his tongue on the roof of his mouth. And then finally, once the color had drained from his spray-tan face, he sat down. "Can I have a glass of water?" he eventually managed to ask, eyes not moving from the empty space where he knew his colleague's wife's legs had been a few months ago at the Christmas party. Shane, I'd worked with him for years. I should never have called him. He didn't deserve to die. People react to the unexplainable in different ways. Some panic, others stay calm and take action. Once we'd fully explained our mourning to him, Shane had been the latter. That's why I had to kill him. For once, my absent-mindedness came in handy. If I hadn't left the hammer on the mantelpiece after putting the new shelf up 3 days ago, it wouldn't have been within easy reach. If it wasn't within easy reach, Shane would have finished dialing 999. And if he had finished dialing 999, Emily would have been carted away to some test facility and I would be alone. Frick that. I didn't choose the sharp end of the hammer on purpose, nor did I intentionally drive the thin wedge right into Shane's temple. I was acting too much on instinct to have planned that thoroughly. The surge of adrenaline had streamlined my inner voice into a caveman grunt that simply meant hit, kill. I dropped the dripping tool the moment I realized what I'd done. I fell to my knees and wept. Once again, a 5-year-old lost in a supermarket. Emily wasn't sobbing or screaming or yelling or making any sounds of distress. She was laughing.
Sweet Mary of Bethlehem. Benedict Bockstead, who thought you had it in you?
Then I was laughing too, still on my knees, face still wet with tears, but laughing all the same. Seems messed up now I'm writing it down. My newly legless wife and I bent double and near hysterics while an innocent estate agent leaked all over the floorboards. Panicking wouldn't have helped, and the looming despair was so thick neither of us would find our way back if we ventured into it. Laughter was the only sensible option.
Lucky Shane was a frick boy whose family live way up in Manchester,
Emily mused as I wrapped his body in black bin liners.
You only called, right? Didn't message. By the time they come looking for him, there'll be no way to trace it to us. Just make sure you dump your phone.
For all her qualities, Emily wasn't smart. For all my faults, many stem from not being the sharpest knife on the rack. That's why I didn't question this now quite obvious, ridiculous assertion that no police would come asking around. Even if I had been blessed with a bit more brains, though, I was too lost in a barely suppressed panic to notice. That's also the reason I didn't fully register the second time I ever heard Emily not use the word frick. Disposing of Shane was a pain in the backside. Emily couldn't help for obvious reasons. A person with no feet isn't much help when dragging the body of a grown man into your back garden. She did sit by the kitchen window. After I had the genius idea of repurposing my office chair and a broom handle into a makeshift wheelchair she could punt around on, and I was appreciative of the company as I went about my first dark deed of the next few months. The conversation made digging and filling the hole much quicker. Plus, I'd always felt planting flowers was a group activity. Petunias are better enjoyed with friends. The next week was strange. Emily did one or two Zoom meetings, but eventually signed off sick from her trendy marketing job. The team would cope without a lead, she'd informed her stammering underlings, laptop poised on her shinless thighs. It was on the morning of the next Saturday, exactly 7 days from the calf incident, that we took our next step on the descent into madness. I was once more awoken by hysterics from Emily's side of the bed. This time, it wasn't crying, though. This time, it was laughter. The same kind of maniacal giggling she'd let loose after I removed Shane from the equation with my dad's old hammer. Still half asleep, I rolled over to see what the joke was. The second round of hysterics was from me, and they very much were filled with sobs, screams, and scrambling away from the woman who shared my bed. My wife had no legs. Her hips ended as the same fleshy, perfect orbs of her now vanished knees had been when we'd gone to sleep the night before. To my growing alarm, Emily wasn't at all perturbed by this.
"Hey," she managed to get out between excited giggles. "I did say I wanted to lose weight."
She was waving her hand through the air where her thighs had once been. My heart thumped in my chest. What was happening to my wife? And why did she seem so happy about it? Still, the change meant I didn't have to carry her around the house, at least. Without the extra weight of her thighs, her arms, now strengthened by a week of office chair punting, were more than capable of functioning as stand-in legs. She'd walk around the house on her palms, laughing softly to herself when she thought I couldn't hear. When I asked her once what was so funny, she simply rolled her eyes and said,
"Don't worry, it's nothing you've done. Something's just tickling the back of my knees. Calm the frick down."
I couldn't calm the frick down. Firstly, because again, she didn't say frick. And secondly, because how was I supposed to be calm when my wife's legs had disappeared with no explanation?
"Look, Benny, it's okay. I can still feel them, but it's just phantom limb syndrome, just like that frickin' show." It took an hour for her to properly explain, mainly because she'd break into more fits of laughter every few minutes. It took another 2 for me to properly calm down, and there was clear reason, too. I knew Emily, and I knew when she wasn't being honest. She didn't believe what she was telling me. To her, this wasn't phantom limb syndrome. In her mind, wherever her legs had gone, they were still with her, still attached to her solid flesh and bone. After how the next few weeks played out, I'm not sure I'd argue with her on that if she'd just come out and said it. Not anymore. I spent until the following Wednesday morning trying to make sense of it all, but then the doorbell rang. I don't know why I let him in the house. When the 20-something Jehovah's Witness asked to come in and speak about Jesus, I was too dazed and quietly terror-stricken to fully realize what I agreed to when I said yes. This time, the hammer strike was deliberate. He had been mid-psalm when the metal wedge connected with the back of his skull. The O in the word hope prolonged and slurred as he crumpled in slow motion, finishing the vowel as a twitching heap on the floorboards I'd only just scrubbed the blood out of. The wet thud of the hammer collapsing the suburban missionary's head had been loud enough to bring Emily knuckling down the stairs. At least I wasn't weeping this time. She found me stood over the body quite calm, cleaning the Jehovah's Witness's blood off the blunt tool with a wet wipe. I was beyond terrified at my actions by this point, you see. I'd fully dissociated, I think. I was lost somewhere behind my eyes, screaming impotently at reality to stop and reverse back to before I answered the door. The argument that followed was the worst and definitely weirdest we'd ever had. She didn't talk to me through the window this time. I had to dig a second hole next to Shane's flower bed in silence, left alone while Emily sat by the upstairs window to keep an eye on the confused-looking religious door knockers peering through front windows all along the street. I could hear her laughing as I dug, angry cackles which she made no attempt to hide.
It was all a frickin' detour, eh? All a distraction, pointless prelude.
I practically flew through the bedroom door. I'd come in for a glass of water when I heard the sound of her shrill ramblings coming down the stairs. The sounds of distress had shaken the kitchen ceiling. No, not distress. Distress was what I started feeling about halfway up the stairs. Emily's shrieking shook the walls of the hallway. She was screaming about, I don't know what, laughing hysterically between every sentence.
I'll be with you soon. I'll be with you soon. Tell the man in charge I'm coming.
When the door slammed open, she shot upright on her windowsill perch, jumping out of her skin. She looked sheepishly at me, biting her lip to suppress the occasional giggle. Emily? I asked, my voice unsure.
Sorry,
she mumbled.
I dozed off. Must have been having a bad dream.
Again, I knew her well enough to know that she believed none of those words. I didn't have the time or courage to confront her, though. My sweaty palms had more petunias to plant. The next few weeks were a paranoid blur. Well, for me at least. I don't think Emily was aware of very much beyond the changes in her body after the Jehovah incident. I decided it wasn't safe for me to take my attention away from her for too long, so I too took some sick leave. COVID-19 was a great cover-up. It would have been hard to explain if we both were expected in an office. I spent my nights at the window, taking long vigils with the lights out, peering through the blinds, and hoping nobody came to claim the guests sleeping under my petunias.
The funny thing is, we think the children are safe. They're the worst of all of us. She knew the truth, though. She wrote it down. They call him every year. They call him every year, and when all's said and done, the town's graveyard just gets fuller. The man in charge can't wait to meet me. He's very angry with you, though.
No, he's not happy with you at all, Benny.
It took me a few days to get used to the dark, unnerving things Emily would holler and giggle into the dark bedroom when I had to head out to use the bathroom or start the next watch at the window. Trying to hold a stable conversation with her was pointless now. Not that I didn't try. Em, are you hungry?
Hungry? Therthathothax, the eight-armed maggot prince, is hungry. The people lost in the pocket dimension of the non-things are hungry. You've never been hungry, Benny. You don't know what hungry is.
Even the most basic questions eventually led to incomprehensible babbling. I learned to look past it. She ate the meals I gave her, after all. What did it matter if I couldn't present them without being paid in mind-curdling titters that made sleep impossible most nights?
My legs, my feet, my tail. My legs, my feet, my tail. My legs, my feet, my tail.
The next change was too much for Emily, I think. What little sanity it remained was gone when I awoke on the morning of the next disappearance. The shoulders, breasts, and head that were once my wife rattled the same words over and over again, her eyes rolling back in her hair, her expression terrified. She didn't even notice me pick her up and put her in the cupboard. The towels and kitchen roll I wedged in the cracks of the old door did little to quiet the noise. If we were the kind of couple that owned a ball gag, I would have used it, but the rolled-up pair of socks would have to do. It didn't seem like she minded as I shut the door, tears streaming down my face. It didn't seem like she was aware of anything but her legs, her feet, her tail. I tried not to dwell on that last one too much while I placed seeds and fertilizer over the Shane and Jehovah mounds. The petunias were wilting, and wilting flowers raise suspicion, I told myself. Neighbors can be nosy. It was best to be careful. That sensible reasoning is why I hit Shane's mother with a hammer when she turned around to shut the front door behind her. I, of course, had the hammer ready when I opened the door. I'm not an idiot. My aim was good as ever. I was also relieved to have something to occupy my time. Upstairs, Emily had managed to dislodge the socks, and tenderly planting fresh petunias on the new mound next to Shane's was a good distraction to occupy myself with for the rest of the day. The police showed up 2 days later, yesterday, so you have context. I had bigger problems by then, though. When I woke yesterday morning, the room was quiet. It took me a few seconds to realize the gentle lull of birdsong wasn't a welcome event. The fact I could hear it meant the hysterical shrieks and cackles from the cupboard had stopped. I know what you're thinking. Surely that was a good thing. Well, it would have been if the soft chuckles and whispers that replaced them weren't far, far worse.
You know, I'm so glad I'm not like you, Benny. I'll get to munch, 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 and crunch, 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 while I watch your skin melty melts, and the shit in your bowels boils until you burst.
When the man in charge meets you, he's going to take your eyes, Benny. He's going to burn you for 1,000,000 years, but you'll never die.
That's what he wants with all of you, Benny. All you scumlings and filthy smalls and screamy squishes.
I'm going to eat them all, Benny.
When I get there, I'm going to eat all of them. All the people. I'm going to eat you too, Benny. You're going to get there eventually with the rest of the underscum. And when you do, I'm going to eat you over and over and over. And when your brains ooze out your ear holes because I've crunch, crunch, crunched down on your skull, do you know what I'm going to do, Benny? I'm going to touch myself.
It took me 5 hours of listening to those sanity-breaking promises before I had the nerve to open the door. Emily's head sat on a cushion of auburn hair at the back of the cupboard. Her green eyes rolled back,
bulging from their sockets. Her cheeks were red as an open blister, brow coated in a thin layer of sweat that matched my own, and flecks of spittle exploded from her mouth as she whispered,
"I'm ready, Benny. I'm ready, and I'm going soon. I can't wait to meet the man in charge. He'll satisfy more than you ever have, Benny."
She wasn't laughing much anymore. She was panting softly, breaths from wherever her lungs had gone, or whatever they now were, coming through fast and shallow. The disembodied head of my wife, whispering pure nightmare fuel, wasn't what made me collapse onto the bedroom carpet and vomit, though. No, it was the voice she spoke with which did that. The whispers reaching my head through unknown mental avenues outside of my ears weren't Emily's. They weren't even human. The syllables came from a battery of voices, each at least an octave higher than the last. All except one, a single bass tone, almost too low to comprehend, that danced in and out of the cascade of degrading noise. The language, the mother tongue of Emily's screeching monologue as it rattled around my skull, I did not recognize. It was no language of this earth. Yet, to my horror, I understood every word.
"Soon I'll be free, Benny. Soon I'll be free, and you'll see me again in 3 years, 9 months, 4 days, 7 hours, 42 minutes, 17 seconds. Then you'll see how I munch, 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 and crunch, crunch, crunch. See who was really inside the filthy small you married."
The rest happened on autopilot. The subconscious taunting whispers didn't stop when I picked up the gibbering head. They remained uninterrupted as I carried her into the bathroom and placed her gingerly on a towel I'd placed on the toilet seat. She continued her foul declarations for every minute it took for the ceramic tub to fill with warm water. And that's how I knew I still loved her. I made sure it wasn't too hot or too cold, and even added some bubble bath before I picked up her still whispering head and plunged it under the surface. Human beings can only survive with lungs full of water for a few minutes. Emily's lips didn't stop moving until she'd been under there for at least 2 hours. I held her temples, tears falling nonstop from my eyes as they remained fixed to her bulging, rolling ones. That is, until they too disappeared. Before the final 10 or so minutes, the rest of Emily's head dematerialized. I nearly slipped face first into the bathwater. The auburn eels of hair worming between my white knuckles vanished. I yelled, brushing aside the bubbles, and only one trace of Emily remained. Plump lips, white teeth, and a waggling tongue, somehow set into a flat piece of skin much shallower than the depth of the mouth it contained. A mouth that was still moving. I rammed my fist into it in the end. I grabbed that tongue and pulled as hard as I could. Anything to stop the whispers, the water did nothing to dull. A deep crimson bloomed beneath the bubbles. The hard biting at my wrist stopped. I wrenched my arm out of the water, holding a single piece of flesh in my grasp. It was a tongue, a blood-soaked, wriggling tongue. Unlike the rest of Emily, there was a wound where it had left her body. The horror at what I'd done slowly dawned on me. I sat alone on the cold tiles, my wife's limp and severed tongue in my hands, and howled. I stayed there, curled in the fetal position next to a bathtub full of my wife's blood, until the police started hammering at the door about 20 minutes ago. The tongue has gone limp, but hasn't vanished. The mouth has, though. Emily has gone, leaving me alone and frightened with the police about to break down the door and find me with the severed tongue of my missing wife.
and 3 bodies buried in my back garden. The thing is, after the last few months, prison doesn't seem that scary. That's why I was calm enough to write all this out. I knew I had to tell my side of the story. Let's be real. Once that battering ram I can hear finally does its job, that's it for me. You'll be hearing about me on the news. The talking heads will tell you I'm a serial killer, a hard-boiled psychopath refusing to reveal the location of my wife's body. I'm going to tell them the truth, but they won't believe it. You and I know better, though. You now know, like I do, that there isn't a body. You'll know, as they put me behind bars for life, that I'm only guilty of 3 of the 4 murders next to my name on Wikipedia. You'll know, like I do, that I'm a 25% innocent man. You'll also know the nagging truth that I think is going to keep me up for many nights to come. Emily had told me when I'd see her again. In 3 years, 9 months, 4 days, 4 hours, 12 minutes, and 32 seconds. That's when I'll see her, when I'll meet the man in charge. That's when, according to Emily, all of her maddening promises will be fulfilled. She could have just been taunting me, teasing me, trying to see just how blatant the untruths she could fill my head with were before I snapped. I don't think that's the case, though. Besides, over the years I knew my wife before I drowned her in my bathtub, she told a lot of tall tales, starting with a particularly tall one about her missing toes. I'm starting to think that maybe her tall tales weren't so tall after all.
Hey, it's Cole Swindell. After I give everything I've got to land a perfect vocal, I usually take 5 before jumping into the next track. And I've learned exactly how to recharge in that time. Some folks grab coffee. I hit a quick good luck spin. Next thing you know, the break is just as fun as laying down the track. A better break makes for a better take. Need a break? Let's chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus TNC supply. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
That was Why I Drowned My Wife. Now, to close out our Tom Russell triple threat, I present Spying on Grandma. Let's get something straight before I start. I'm not, and wasn't, a little pervert or peeping Tom. When I say I spied on my grandma in the shower, I mean once, one time, singular. It wasn't something I did regularly as some kind of Freudian habitual neuroses. Trust me, once was enough. Spying on people, especially naked people, wasn't a childhood preoccupation of mine. Okay, yes, I was spying on my family in the shower and had been for a few weeks before the grandma incident, but the goal wasn't to see their, as I thought of them, naughty parts. I was a normal kid, and the majority of my thoughts were on normal kid things like Cartoon Network and N64. It's important to me that you understand this. I was an innocent child, even by the standards of most 7-year-olds. I ended up seeing what I saw because of reasons that were nothing to do with nudity, and everything to do with a harmless jump-scare prank. The incident happened in the summer of 98, the last summer where it wasn't just Dad and me. I was 7 years old, and like all 7-year-olds, had to come up with interesting ways to entertain myself through the 6-week break whenever parents were too busy to take me to the park or some other child-distracting place. One of the games I devised for myself that summer was Toilet Ghosts. The rules of the game were simple. Over the course of the summer, I was going to make my family, Mum, Dad, and Grandma, believe that our bathroom was haunted. My room was right next to the bathroom. For those unfamiliar with the layout of industrial-era terraced houses in the UK, it might help to know that in most, the lavatory and shower bathtub share a space. The idea for Toilet Ghosts came to me when I was looking for something under my bed. That's when I found the hole. It was a sound of Dad grunting that alerted me to it,
I was lining up, army men ready to shoot my Nerf gun, when I realized the sounds of straining coming through the old walls were much clearer under the bed than they should be. I was facing away from the wall at the time, so I looked behind me towards where I knew the bathroom was. Down by my left foot, there was a section of wall missing, a perfect circle, roughly the diameter of a tennis ball. Now that I'm an adult, I realize it was where the toilet had been at one point, before a previous occupant decided to rearrange the plumbing. They'd done a rushed job, which is why, instead of filling the hole properly, they'd opted to file down the ceramic pipe on either side of the wall and plug up the gap with a loose-fitting half-brick. A half-brick my parents had just decided to paint over. A half-brick that came loose easily in my tiny hands. My memories of the first time I peered through the mystery hole, as I initially thought of it, are almost as crystal clear as the last. The other side of the hole was at the base of the bathroom sink, behind where my mom kept the toilet brush and various bathroom cleaning products Dad had no idea how to use. From my vantage point, I could see almost the whole bathroom. In the dim light cast from the narrow porthole-style window on the opposite wall, I had a full view of the glistening off-white tiles, drab mauve wallpaper, and of course, the shower. The toilet was about a foot to the right of the hole, so I couldn't see much of Dad but his ankles and toes. I watched his foot tap for a few minutes while he strained, holding my hand over my mouth to silence the gleeful chuckling at having a window into this private moment. He'd have had no idea, were it not for my scream. As I was watching, still delighting in the secrecy and stealthiness of it all, something long and thin and hairy unfurled over the lip of the shaved pipe at the hole's other end. My eyes widened in horror as another and another and another of the prickly limbs curled themselves around the rim, prodding and probing for my terrified features. My eyes bulged, my heart hammering against my ribs. Then, before I could react, the furry, multi-limbed monstrosity lunged at me.
Ah, get it off, I hate spiders!
I squealed and rolled out from under the bed. The errant spider flew from my face, scuttling away to sulk in a distant corner of my bedroom. What few hairs were on my arms at that age stood up when I heard my dad's echoey cry from beneath the bed.
Jesus Christ, what in God's name was that? Susan! Susan, come up to the bathroom!
The deliciousness of the idea my 7-year-old mind put together in that moment excited me so much a lump caught in my throat. Toilet Ghost was born. Game on. So, that's the first half of the equation. You know about the hole and why I was looking down it. Now, you need the other half. You know how I was spying on her, and why. But what you still don't know is about Grandma. This is where things stop getting so whimsical and innocent. It's been 23 years since I saw her, but I remember the ensemble more clearly than even my wedding day. When I tried to describe, through tears, the hell I'd been through between terms to the class, I didn't have a wide enough vocabulary to describe her accurately. I'd sputtered and sobbed words like monster, nightmares, and dead people smell. Now I'm older, I can do the creature that stalked my 7th summer more justice. Her skin was clay-like, mottled and almost gray, waxy to the touch, and pudgy in texture. She was huge, with a waistline my 7-year-old self retold as being big enough to eat 10 of me. She'd sit in my dad's recliner all day, her many folds and bulges moving and shifting at tectonic speeds. Her face, though, her face was something else. Botox was huge in the 90s. If you've ever seen a bad Botox job, you'll have a rough idea of the odd way my grandma's knobbled, swollen features moved far too little when she talked. I didn't know what nerve damage was at the time. My parents' explanations didn't do much to dispel comparisons my brain made between her stiff features and the prosthetic creatures in the horror movie I'd given myself nightmares with the previous Christmas. What didn't help was her teeth. Her eyes were unsettling, too. All sunken and dim and unmoving. But it was the bulky square canines and incisors,
that freaked me out so much it took me a week to look her in the face over the dinner table. As I said, her teeth were square, perfectly square, all of them. They ran uniform along her cement-gray gums, each brilliant white, postage-stamp-sized chunk of enamel placed at a perfect right angle with its neighbors. I think the teeth freaked Mom and Dad out, too. At least, the snippets of conversation I stole from the echoes coming up the stairs seemed to suggest as such. "I've never seen her take them out if they are," was one that came up a lot, and, "She didn't pack a toothbrush, Susan." They'd only mentioned them the nights before they smelled of wine and demanded I keep the TV volume low over breakfast, though. I don't have many memories of Grandma before she moved in. I don't remember Grandpa, the man whose death was the catalyst to her joining our household, at all. She'd only been living with us a few months at the time my father was the first unwilling toilet ghost contestant. I didn't know much about the elderly before she came to stay. I was glad to learn, as I grew older, that the bizarre and unsettling behavior I witnessed that summer had nothing to do with aging, and everything to do with her. I was too inexperienced with them to know that Grandma didn't act like other old people. She didn't really act like any people at all. She'd say odd things when I was alone in the living room with her. The conversations she and my mom and dad had were nonsensical enough. When I was lying awake in bed at night, I'd hear snippets of arguments between my parents. Sentences like, "I know she's your mother, Susan, but she's barmy. Don's death broke her." "It's not healthy for Michael. He matters too." And, "The doctor said it's early onset. It's only going to get worse, not better," would drift up the stairs. Words and phrases like dementia, Lewy body syndrome, and care home, the implications of which I wouldn't understand until I was older. The things Grandma used to say to me without my parents around were beyond the addled ramblings of a mind ravaged by a degenerative condition. Even as a kid, I knew the difference between confused nonsense and deliberate, malicious intent. "You know, if you tell anyone, I'll come for you," she'd hissed at me one afternoon while I was keeping myself occupied with a Lego set on the carpet. "If you say a word, I'll come for you and suck out the jelly insides of your precious little eyes through a straw." Another example that my mind can't seem to shake is the morning when Mum had to pop out to the shops. I ended up hiding in my room, cowering under the duvet while she bellowed at me up the stairs. "I can take everything from you, you trembling little meat sack, you sniveling waste of skin. Just be glad you're too small for anything to notice you." As you'd expect, I'd always burst into tears. Mom and Dad would calm me down, trying to soothe me by explaining ad infinitum that Grandma was old, that she didn't know what she was doing. By the time of the incident, I was terrified of her. Not just because of the things she'd say directly to me, either. The things I caught her saying when she didn't know I was listening creeped me out just as much. "This one's no good. Draws too much attention. Can't move fast. They'll notice. Need more padding around the mouth parts. Think the male and runt suspect the teeth. We'll have to be the female. Female, past conventional beauty prime, can blend." These nonsensical ramblings were all pieces of a puzzle I still don't want to put together. I'm not sure I can stand back to take in the whole picture once it's finished. Not without snapping, at least. Mom and Dad didn't believe my frantic recollections of the wild and dangerous words I'd overheard Grandma spouting. They definitely refused to accept that my explanation for where the television remote had disappeared to was anything other than a lie to get Grandma out of the house. Because I didn't just catch Grandma saying weird stuff. I caught her eating weird stuff, too. It started small. Stray pieces of Lego, old coins she'd found down the back of the sofa, any lighters or cigarettes Dad was foolish enough to leave laying around. I watched her consume all of these at one point or another, whenever I was left alone in her care. The TV remote was the thing that took it too far for me.
Kids are much more resilient than adults when it comes to the inexplicable untruths bubbling under the surface of reality. But the remote was too much for even a 7-year-old. Mom and Dad had gone somewhere or other for the evening. I was sitting cross-legged in front of the telly, trying to lose myself in robot wars and drown out the steady barrage of grotesque threats. We were 4 weeks into summer by that point. As much as her words unnerved and rattled me, I'd survived enough of them to have built up a smidgen of tolerance.
"Here, runt. Look at this."
Something about her gravelly words was different. They always held undertones of poison, but this time it wasn't the same snakebite venom as usual. This was a different toxicity, a tainted nectar of the kind behemoth rainforest plants used to lure unsuspecting hummingbirds into gaping maws. Taken by surprise, I lowered my guard and turned from the TV. Grandma was leering down at me from her chair. She was holding the TV remote in one hand, the gnarled nails of the other digging into the arm of Dad's chair. On anyone else's face, her shriveled eyes would have sparkled with a sadistic malice to match the wide, perfectly symmetrical teeth of that smile. As it was, the dead orbs stared at opposite corners of the room. It didn't matter. I knew when Grandma addressed me, it was only the enamel locked in those granite-colored gums that mattered.
"I'm not going to be around much longer, runt," she sneered,
words still dripping with Trojan malice.
"You'll be pleased to hear that, I'm sure, you pathetic stain on your gene pool. Of all of them I've encountered, you're the worst."
I could feel my bottom lip trembling. As usual, this only seemed to egg her on.
"I can't suffer the indignance of a pustule so undeserving of that skin walking around this backwater cesspit, not knowing just how insignificant they actually are."
Before I could start sobbing, before the fluttering in my lungs could evolve into full-blown panic, she lifted the TV remote. I screamed so loudly, the neighbors on both sides yelled, "Keep that damn kid under control!" The lower half of her waxy face clicked and shifted. Her jaw extended slowly, the flesh making the groaning, creaking sounds of rubber dragged across a bed of broken glass. For a full half a minute, it juddered and protruded until her chin jutted out a full foot from her neck. The inexplicable gaze from her teeth never left my screaming face as she lowered the remote into her gullet. The cement gums wriggled, puckering and closing the impossibly angular dentistry around her forearm, remote and all, independently of the rest of her motionless face. I continued bawling against the backdrop of neighborly complaints as the mouth within her mouth suckled and slavered at her buried forearm. She pulled the limb out slowly, white teeth leaving deep and perfectly square imprints on her clay flesh. Not that it would have made any difference to how fast I sprinted up the stairs to my room, but the chunky TV remote in her mucus-covered hand was gone. I refused to leave my room for a week. That was fine by my parents. They didn't believe me anyway, and I was grounded as such. It was exactly 7 days from the remote that I plucked up the courage to, in my mind, get back at Grandma. Because at the end of the week, when she got out of her chair and ascended the stairs to the bathroom for her weekly shower, I made a decision. Grandma was going to be the next unwilling toilet ghost contestant. I'll fully disclose here, I was 7, but I wasn't stupid. I'd seen enough daytime TV to know what a heart attack was and how you shouldn't shock old people because of them. I knew full well the risks of subjecting a lady as old as Grandma to the levels of jump scare toilet ghost brought my parents. I have no shame in admitting I knew this. It's the first and probably only memory I have of deciding to willingly hurt another human being. But a heart attack was kind of the goal. Dad had gone to work a night shift, leaving Mom and I alone with Grandma. I lay in wait by the hole, listening to the stairs creak under the nightmarish woman's massive bulk.
I didn't have any problems with stifled giggling over the invasion of privacy this time. My mind was focused, sharp. This round of Toilet Ghost wasn't a friendly match. I'd never had the balls to play the game with Grandma. I'd had a lot more practice since my first round against Dad, though. I'd perfected my ghost sounds now. I'd learned how to bend my moans and bounce my haunting whispers off the 10 or so inches of ceramic pipe so well that Mum nearly didn't get her trousers down in time more than once. "Come on, you freakish old coot," I muttered to myself as I heard the click and swing of the bathroom door opening. "Get nice and settled. I'm going to Toilet Ghost you so bad you'll wish you never ate that remote." I had to try hard not to breathe too loud. The mix of anticipation, nerves, and anger had me sucking up whole lungfuls through each nostril with every tense shift of my diaphragm. My throat filled with the acrid reek of bleach, and I almost coughed right at the moment she stood in front of the hole while doing something or other at the bathroom sink. She stood for a full 5 minutes, saying nothing and barely moving. I was about to Toilet Ghost her back into Grandpa Don's arms when she took a few steps backwards. The moment her lumbering, naked form came into full view, the cocktail of emotions gave way to one singular, overpowering feeling. Terror. Pure, unbridled terror. I was too scared to scream. I stared, wide-eyed, tears silently falling down my cheeks, while I bit into my hands so hard I could taste the metallic warmth of open wounds. Grandma's head was empty. Blank voids were all that existed behind her lips and eyelids. With each quaking step, her head became more and more deflated until, by the time she stood still, all that existed above her pudgy neck was a near-flat mass of skin. The nightmare I found myself in didn't give me time to process this, though. It was already lining up the next traumatic mental image it took me years to repress. As I watched, praying that my whimpers were quiet enough to go unnoticed, Grandma's belly opened. A red horizontal line unzipped from her left to right flank, an equatorial wound perfectly aligned with the deep crater containing her belly button. The headless torso started to flap and wobble. Her mottled arms deflated, a wet, sucking sound accompanying the slow decompression of each appendage. Then, in a fluid motion, the quivering torso that remained lifted at the belly slit. Something pushed it away, discarding the unwanted flaps of human skin like wet tissue paper. When the memories of the next few moments came flooding back to me last night, I puked for a solid hour. The thing that stepped out of my grandma's skin shivered. Its opaque, stone-gray, gelatinous form pulsated until the residual leg arch left at its base from occupying its human shell had flattened. It heaved and rippled as it bloomed to its full height. The grotesque cylindrical body extended in pulsing spasms until it stood easily at 8 feet tall. Its bulbous head rocked and swayed as it stretched long, cramped muscles, the unspeakable anatomy realigning to support the weight of its true form. The head had no eyes, no nose, no features at all on its slick gray surface, save for one. The mouth. The wide, square-toothed, impossibly perfect angles of that damn mouth. Folds of glistening flab puckered around the brilliant white teeth. From somewhere deep in its throat, 3 long greenish tongues, each several inches in diameter, emerged to probe the air. They were several times the total length of the thing that had worn my grandma by the time they were fully extended. Each of the 3 appendages set about a task. One turned the shower on, and the 2 others began curling around my grandma's husk. The thing slithered around the room on its slug-like foot, whilst the tongues got to work. A pang of disgust rose in my belly, nausea churning dangerously close to vomiting. I realized, with growing horror, that once a week, this blasphemy against the laws of reality had been emerging to clean my grandmother's skin. While I had been sleeping, It had scrubbed and scraped the only remains of the woman who had birthed my mother. The thought that this whole summer I'd been listening to the running water on the other side of the wall while those three tongues defiled and preserved a human flesh suit, it became too much. I couldn't watch the thrashing greenish, maw-born limbs any longer. I turned away from the hole, expelling everything I'd eaten that day onto the carpet under my bed. By the time I'd finished, I was spitting up nothing but flecks of bile. My chest ached, both from hurling and from the unstoppable pounding of my panicking heart. Shuddering, drawn by that morbid curiosity known only to children and sociopaths, I lifted my head and looked back through the hole. There, staring back at me from only 10 short inches away, was a set of angular, chalk-white teeth. I'd never heard Mum run up the stairs so fast. She damn near threw the door off its hinges when she burst into the room. She tried to yell above my screams to get through to me, but it was no good. I wouldn't stop screeching about Grandma in the bathroom, pointing at the wall and trying to claw my way as far into her embrace as possible. I begged her to run. I begged her so hard my already hoarse throat started to burn redraw. She didn't scoop me up, carry me downstairs and strap me into the car. She didn't leave a trail of lighter fluid and throw a match through the letterbox as she left. She didn't pick up Dad and drive us as far away from the house we burned down and the thing inside as we possibly could. No, Mum did what all good mums do. She stood up, sat me on the bed, wiped my eyes, and told me she'd show me there was nothing to be afraid of. Then she went into the bathroom. I hid under the duvet the moment I heard her scream. Thankfully, her dying pleas and the series of bangs, crashes, and organic ripping, squelching sounds that followed didn't last too long. The silence that followed the cacophony was worse. I knew Dad wasn't going to be home until morning. After an hour or two, I decided that I had to look out from under the duvet. I'd almost managed to convince myself that I'd been asleep, that it had been a nightmare. One glance at Mum's twitching silhouette in the doorway was enough to tell me how wrong I was. I was sobbing uncontrollably under the duvet as I heard her shamble over to the bed. I could feel her as she stood above me for what must have been hours. I could see daylight from the window outside piercing through the cheap bedding when she finally leant down close to where my ear was.
"Remember, Runt, if a word of this leaves your filthy parasite lips, we'll know."
You can imagine the state Dad found me in when he got back from his shift. You can imagine the state he was in when he'd learned Mum and Grandma had disappeared. They never found remains of either of them. By the time Dad got home, the thing had managed to clean the bathroom. I don't know what it did with Grandma's skin, but the flashbacks of that protruding jaw and square teeth puckered around a forearm give me a solid guess. They found Mum's car by the coast. Eventually, they gave up looking for a body. I still remember the gentle-mannered police officer consoling my crying father after informing him that they had to assume Mum, overcome with grief over the dementia, had taken Grandma so they could walk out into the sea together, swallowed up by the waves, as he was his grave. The rest of my life was exactly as you'd expect. Counseling and trauma therapy were a big, big part of it. I told everyone, especially Dad, what I'd seen. Nobody believed me, which is probably why I've been allowed to live so long. I was told by the army of doctors, therapists, counselors, and the like that it was a false memory created by my mind to cope with the horrific events that actually took place. For a few happy decades, I managed to believe that, too. The truth of that night in my mind throughout my adult life has been that Mum had told me we were going to the coast and had been very upfront about what for.
She tried to take me by force, and even bitten me during her psychotic break. At some point, I passed out from fear. Worrying that she'd killed me in her addled state, she then drove off to the coast with Grandma without me. All was going well. After a rocky adolescence and early 20s, I'm 30 now and married, have stable employment, a home, a life, a nice, normal life. At least it was until last night. Because last night, when we were watching a news segment about the UN climate crisis summit, I saw them at the back of a crowd of suited dignitaries and politicians. A set of perfectly square, impossibly white teeth, grinning from between pudgy, waxen lips. Pudgy, waxen lips on a face that I recognized. A face that hasn't changed much at all since 1998, aside from a slight graying of the skin and a new, angular smile. It was Mum. The memories came flooding back all at once. Like I said, I puked for an hour. Kath, my wife, was worried. As soon as I could stop retching, I explained it all to her. Grandma, Mum, that smile, the thing that wore both their skins. Kath's jaw dropped. I thank God she believes me and that, unlike Mum, she's agreed to drive to the remotest place we can find. She's agreed to go off-grid with me, agreed to hide away from the monster she's never seen up close, but knows in her bones is real. Why does she believe me, you ask? Simple. The second I'd collapsed into a sobbing heap at my story's climax, my phone buzzed. It was seeing the color drain from my face faster than she ever had that prompted Kath to snatch it from my hands. Her reaction was worse. I had to hold her for a solid 2 hours once I'd managed to stop her trying to barricade herself inside a kitchen cupboard. I'd received a picture message from a private number. It was a picture of Kath and I in our living room, taken from right outside the front window, that night, judging by our clothing, with a single sentence attached. "We told you we'd know if you told, Runt." I don't think that's what sent her over the edge, though. No, I think what sent her over the edge is what we also saw in that photo. Our living room runs from the front to the back of the house. If you looked in our front window, you could see our back garden through the sliding glass doors. What made convincing Kath so easy was that in the photo, you could clearly see a wide set of white, square teeth leering at the back of our heads from the pitch-black garden. You've just heard Spying on Grandma by Tom Russell. Tom Russell is a writer based in the UK. In addition to penning horror stories, Tom also enjoys gaming, retro television, and Dungeons & Dragons. That closes up our episode tonight, folks. What? That was 3 whole stories. You still want more? Well, fine. How about this? Next week, since it's both the season finale and Thanksgiving here in the good old USA, I've got a special treat in store for you. And no, it's not that green bean casserole that Drew Blood keeps emailing me for. You'll have to wait until next week to find out what it is, but let me dangle some succulent tidbits in front of you for the time being. It's got demons, it's got evil wizards, and it's got the most heavy metal monster ever destroying the French countryside. I'd like to extend my thanks to Tom Russell for the highly entertaining stories tonight, as well as you all for joining me. I hope you can find time around your holiday next week to jump in for more Horror Hill, because things are about to get colossal. You've been listening to the Horror Hill Podcast, a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights. Tonight's episode was hosted, narrated, scored, and finalized by yours truly,
Eric Peabody. Additional music by Nikki McSorley. Got a terrifying tale of your own that you'd like performed? Email it to us at submissions@simplyscarypodcast.com to have your work considered for future production. Note that any writing utilizing artificial intelligence is ineligible. If you enjoyed tonight's episode, why not help us spread our dark presence online? You can follow Chilling Tales for Dark Nights on social media, and upvote, subscribe, and hit the bell notification icon if you're listening to this on YouTube. It helps us out a lot and also keeps you up to date on new episodes. If you'd like access to uninterrupted horror, free of ads and these annoying bookend segments, might I recommend signing up to be a patron? You'll get access to hundreds of episodes of this show, as well as everything from the other programs in the Chilling Tales for Dark Nights cabal. That means all of Scary Stories Told in the Dark, Drew Blood's Dark Tales, and more. It's a veritable smorgasbord of horrific delights. Head to chillingtalesfordarknights.com to get started. If you're looking for someone to narrate or handle audio production for your own personal project, I just so happen to know a guy. Email me at ericpeabodyvoice@gmail.com, that's ericpeabodyvoice, and we can talk details. If darkness is what you're after, listener, your search is over. Yet, let it be known, you haven't found the darkness. The darkness has found you.
Bubba Wallace here from 2311 Racing. You know what's slower than a pace car? Waiting at the car wash. That's when I fire up Chumba Casino. It turns those slow minutes into fast fun. With new games every week, you'll never get bored. Next time you're stuck in the slow lane, speed up with Chumba. Play now at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.